Let's make it happen, Captain!
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag. And today, we have Strange looking right at me there. It's kind of a little different. One interesting thing, though, I talked to some people on the Bing team.
Mm-hmm.
I accused them of setting up animals to look at me when we shoot. They admitted it. They admitted it. They do it. They do it. And then today, I get this. So I'm going to meet with the Bing team on June 18th when I get back from Tech Ed North America, and we're going to talk this out. We're going to try to figure out, how do they come up with these pictures? Where do they come from? How does this happen? So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting interview. Watch for that. Let's get started today. First, from Dave, he says, from time to time, my Windows 7 64-bit laptop will suddenly experience a lot of disk I.O. Using Resource Monitor and the disk tab sorted by total bytes per second, it appears that the system process is a process doing almost all the disk I.O. at the times when this happens. Most of the disk I.O. is reads, and the disk activity listing shows various files more than a screenful over the disk being accessed, all over the disk being accessed. Using sysinternals procmon on PID4, it reports that the top reads most are related to semantic antivirus. Are there any special OS API calls? If any process were to call them, they'd be seen under the PID as well. What's really going on here? And you've gone back and forth on this one.
Yeah, it's really the semantic mini filter driver for the disk that is doing this. It's not associated with any particular process. It's just happens to be the system thread that is doing this work on behalf of other processes.
Yeah. So, okay. So it's just semantic going through doing its thing.
I mean, it's perfectly
looking
normal
for viruses. So that's how that's going to go. And you hear that sometimes if you have a bladder drive.
Mm-hmm.
All right, from Devin. First, I'd like to say that the show rocks and has been a big help. Okay, one of our users just had a virus. I was able to remove the virus easily and then ran numerous scans. I ended up doing a system restore to a point a few days back. Once the system came back up, everything was running like nothing ever happened except for Windows backup. I get the error that I attached, and I've gone through the steps described in link. And still have no luck. I've also created a new backup and still nothing. The backup was working fine until the virus. On the SPP log, I noticed that it says shadow copy creation failed because of errors reported by ASR Writer. Does this mean that the virus changed the system partition in a way that can no longer be backed up? Is there any way to fix this? Any help? Much appreciated. Keep up the good work.
So this is another one where we went back and forth actually quite a number of times. These kinds of issues, you know, just a single error code is not always helpful, you know, depending on what happened to the system. So we dug in a little bit more, and we actually found out that there was an active partition at the end of the drive that was about, like, 2 meg in size, mm-hmm. or 4 meg in size. Anyways, a really small active partition for no reason. It could have been caused by the virus. We don't really know.
Yeah.
But the error message essentially said, you know, the backup could not do what it was designed to do because there wasn't enough free space on the active partition. So by deleting that partition, resetting the system drive as being the active partition, everything was actually fine, and they were able to do backup again. Along with that, we found that it's normal for the full PC backup to actually require more than 40% free space on the drive that you're backing up in order to store the temporary image file that it's going to create, even if you're putting that file onto another drive. So if you're doing full PC backups and you're doing an online full PC backup, you're going to have a non-full drive that you're backing up to. Otherwise, you know, you want to move to something more all-inclusive if you're doing full system backups, something where the system itself is offline.
Cool. Okay. From Amir, first of all, thank you for producing the show, which is extremely helpful. My problem is that whenever I try to install a new OS on my computer, like Windows Vista or Windows Consumer Preview, I try to boot from the installation DVD, but it doesn't work. It either gives me some text that says, press any key to boot from CD, and when I press any key, nothing happens at all, or giving me a message and start booting, or doesn't give me any message and starts booting from the hard drive with the existing OS. The BIOS settings are set to make the DVD drive the first booting drive, and I tried these CDs on other computers, and they work perfectly. I need to install Windows by booting from the CD and not from the OS environment because I want to install 64-bit OS on existing OS, which is 32-bit. And I want to format the hard drive, and I want to install Windows on it and have Windows 7 Ultimate 2 gig RAM processor. It goes on.
Mm-hmm. So
I haven't seen this before.
Oddly enough, I have seen it before, and it may actually be how they've done the DVD and the machine that it's trying to be booting from.
Yeah.
If they've got a 64-bit DVD, they might be trying to boot EFI, and if the BIOS itself doesn't support any sort of EFI, it may fail, which is why it works on other machines. You know, it's highly unlikely that it's a bad disk because it does work on other machines. What the best thing that you can try for in this case is reflashing the BIOS to the latest BIOS. It might bring additional support.
Would using a thumb drive for the installation media make a difference?
Thumb drive might make a difference. And, you know, there's many links out there on how to do it. It's relatively simple.
Hanselman thumb drive.
Yep.
That'll get you there.
The other thing to do is on many systems that are boot, when they're booting, they'll send a message that says, you know, hit F10 for boot menu.
Yeah.
Which is different than just letting the system find the DVD.
Yeah, I always wondered about that.
So you can hit that. It'll usually give you a little menu.
Yeah.
And say, you know, specifically boot from the DVD drive, and it'll attempt to boot from that.
Cool.
So a couple of different options. We haven't heard back on whether or not any of that has worked.
Yeah. Okay. From Corey, he says, I'm running Windows 7 64-bit with all the updates. I'm receiving this error 1910 whenever I try to uninstall any program that uses Windows installer service. Warning 1910, could not remove shortcut skype.lnk. Verify that the shortcut file exists and you can access it. I tried to do the following without any success. MSI exec unregister, MSI exec slash reg server. I hope that you can help me with this error. Thanks for being a very informative podcast. Podcast, come on. Watch the video, man. You're missing all this.
We've gone, again, this is one that's taken, I think, 2 or 3 days worth of going back and forth on. Eventually, we found out what caused the issue.
Yeah.
Which was this particular user turned off UAC on his machine.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, because turning off UAC and then installing applications and uninstalling applications, it changes the state. Like, UAC does a bunch of things with respect to setting ACLs on resources, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you turn off UAC and you install applications, many, many applications since Vista On has taken a dependency on the fact that UAC is the default and will react completely differently when UAC is turned off, and even unexpectedly, because you have applications that are like, okay, it'll do an OS version check of being XP and then do some stuff, and then it'll do a version check of being Vista and then do some stuff, and then Win 7 and do some stuff, and it won't take into effect that, oh, UAC might be off on that machine because the majority of users' machines have it on. Mm-hmm. So they do is Win 7 check, yes, but not a UAC off check, and then things go awry. They can set ACLs on things that they should not have set because they might have fallen back into code that would work on XP but doesn't work on future versions of the OS.
And explain ACLs just for anyone who might not know.
Permissions. You know, basically those are the rights that a user has to the files on the system. We still haven't come up with the perfect solution for this, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Even turning back on UAC is not enough because the damage has actually been done.
Yeah.
The issues in this particular case are there are shortcuts in the public profile that aren't able to be found for whatever reason. I'd really need to reproduce this particular error. I mean, I haven't been able to reproduce this problem yet. So it's additionally a problem that could have been caused by turning off UAC and then doing something else. It's completely unrelated.
Yeah.
So his machine is unfortunately in a really bad state right now.
Yeah.
But we're still working on it, and hopefully we'll have an actual solution to it without wiping the machine.
Cool. All right. We'll keep you updated. Next question. I've got an Acer E machine running Windows 7 64-bit, and I'm hooking it up to my TV using HDMI to DVI cable. Obviously, the HDMI end of the cable is plugged into my laptop and DVI end of the cable into the TV. I've got a beautiful picture, but I can't get any sound to come out of the speakers. I've tried going in control panel, sounds, clicking show hidden devices, but the only thing that pops up is an old TV I hooked up with a normal HDMI cable. Anyone know why I can't get sound through my TV? Which pin on a DVI cable carries the sound?
Pin 34?
Yeah, so you need to isolate pin 34, and it was a ground loop problem too, right?
Yeah, it was a ground loop.
No, DVI doesn't have audio in it, so that's your problem. If you're going to go to your TV, you need to use HDMI all the way through.
Or, I mean, you could go HDMI to DVI and then have a separate audio, you know, toss link.
Yeah,
just good old-fashioned stereo.
And if you have a TV that has DVI on it, you probably also have two RCA jacks for audio.
Exactly.
So you can just plug a little eighth-inch connector that goes to two RCAs and plug that into the back of the TV, and they'll get you there, too. But
you're better off doing HDMI only, of course, if your particular machine allows audio out over your HDMI port, not every last machine does that.
That is true. That's true.
So, you know, even if you do hook up HDMI to HDMI, it's possible that you still won't get audio.
Unlikely, but it's possible.
Yeah, any new machine, like in the past 3 years.
Or TV. The TV's thing.
So. Yeah, no, if you couldn't get audio over HDMI on your TV, like from at the TV level, there's something really wrong with your TV.
I have one of those TVs. Yeah, I got a really old TV that has an old HDMI, and anytime I try to get audio through it, it's just not a good thing. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, you must
but
have.
But I think it might be the computer that I'm using. Mm-hmm. I think it's like, you know, 1.3 on one and not on the other, and it's probably a problem with the computer. So I don't know. I can't blame the TV entirely, but yeah, it might not work. So there's one option for you, use a cable.
Right.
Next question. Windows 7, I've installed the Firefox browser, which apparently registers itself as a default FTP handler, but it doesn't handle FTP very well. How can I make FTP links open in IE but keep Firefox as my default browser? Help them, Gove?
I think we should.
Okay.
I think it's within our capabilities.
Okay, then.
If you go to, click the Perl start menu, default programs, or go to Control Panel and Default Programs, you will have an option here for associate file type or protocol with a program.
Mm-hmm.
Let it wait and do its thing, and then click Find FTP. So obviously I have mine associated with IE.
Yeah.
If you double click this, you will see Firefox and IE as...
If you haven't installed
as a registered handler. You just have to set IE again as your handler.
Yeah,
and then hit OK, and that's basically all you need to do.
Easy.
And then in Firefox, and again, it's been a while since I've actually looked at Firefox, there should be an option in there so that it doesn't continually try to take over the handler to just uncheck FTP.
Okay, cool, awesome. All right, next question. I have Windows 7 Ultimate 32-bits, but I need to install some programs by Adobe that require 64-bit versions. Is there any way I can upgrade to 64-bit with no new installation? Because I don't want to upgrade all my files and get through all that long process installing all again. Unfortunately, I don't have the time to.
There is nothing that you can do.
Yeah.
But to explain this a little bit more, an upgrade, even if you're going from Vista 32 to Win7 32, is not the classic sense of upgrade anymore, where all of your files are left on the disk and then the OS is kind of grafted over top.
It doesn't
work that way anymore. It hasn't for a while. When you upgrade, it is actually a clean install plus migration.
Mm-hmm.
So we lay down the entire new OS and we look at the old OS and say, okay, what do we need to pick out of here to re-inject into the new OS and then bring up as if, you know, you had installed all of that stuff over top. That's how the actual upgrade process works. There is no upgrade process where where it wouldn't be, you know, a long period of time to install everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Windows Anytime upgrade, which is more...
That's quick.
That's quick, and that's more of enabling features that are currently present but disabled due to the key.
Yeah, plus a couple of downloads here.
Plus a couple of downloads, right. Now, in order to make this easy, what you can do is the User State Migration Wizard, or Windows Easy Transfer,
mm-hmm.
which will back up your docs and settings and everything, not your applications, you will have to reinstall your application. Yeah. So there's just no option around that.
Yeah, it's going to be a full process, so get the time. Find the time.
And honestly, this would be a good impetus to figure out your backup story, because if you're in a state where it is taking fundamentally too long for you to do this, think of the disaster mode, right?
Yeah.
There will be a time where you must do this, so figure out how to make it as quick and easy as possible, right? So make sure you have your application stored off somewhere, the ones that you must reinstall, keep them up to date.
Yeah.
Your data settings, keep that in a particular place, make sure that that's backed up. I mean, I think we're pretty much poster children for disaster recovery and disaster preparedness.
I like to think I am. So I think I'm all right. The only thing is that I think I'd like to be able to flatten and get back to a good state faster. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at WIM and VHD as an option.
Absolutely.
There. And
absolutely.
PrEP and that kind of stuff. So if you really want to be able to, you know, rubber band back from a catastrophic disaster, that's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm.
All right, next question. I remember Windows XP where you could edit the associations to not only change what program would open a certain file, but edit individual items in a file's right-click context menu. You could also edit command line options if you wanted to. I'd like to do this with batch files so that I can change the edit option to open the batch file with Notepad 2. Double-clicking would still execute the open command, so the batch file executes as normal. It appears this advanced functionality in Windows 7 has been removed and replaced by features that simply allow you to change what program a file opens with. Any way I can get a batch file to open for edit in a text editor of my choice?
There is. The user is completely correct that the advanced editing functionality was removed in Vista. It just, unfortunately, wasn't used enough, and it caused additional problems with people changing things that they shouldn't have.
Yeah.
Right? So, but you can do this in the registry. We go to HKEY classes root batch file right here. You go down to the shell edit command. You can actually just change what you want it to be. You can change this entire path to be, you know, Notepad 2, keep the %1, which passes along the file that you're trying to edit.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically it. That's all you got to do.
Cool. Awesome. All right. Next question. This is an interesting one. I want to make Windows 7 case sensitive when it read-writes anything on the hard drive, the C drive or any other NTFS drive. I found a video that says to change your registry key current version Explorer Advanced don't pretty path to a value of 1. I also found a Windows support item that says something about modifying the registry key current control set, control session manager, kernel, ob, case, and sensitive that leads me to assume putting a value of 0 make Windows case sensitive with NTFS files. I have a feeling the second solution is the answer, but I'm not sure, and I want to make sure before doing anything. That just sounds dangerous as all heck. Making Windows case sensitive. So
we have the option there for a reason, right? It was for really interoperability with Unix systems.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it first came up. It's turned off for a reason. It is tested in an off state. Nobody tests with the file system being case sensitive, right? So if you turn it on, you're pretty much on your own with whatever issues might occur.
Yeah, I'm thinking like, you know, shortcuts that I might have typed in, stuff myself, and paths.
Things that the apps have installed with.
Yeah.
You know, if...
There's no guarantee that some third-party app might have used
that might rely
case.
on the fact that it is case insensitive.
Yeah.
And most things actually do rely on the fact that it's case insensitive.
And a lot of times I've seen paths that are like... a path to, like, you know, the Windows directory or something that's all uppercase.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to get hosed right off the bat.
The potential for errors and issues by changing this are astronomical.
Yeah.
So let me
dive down this little rabbit hole a little bit. Let's say you do that, mm-hmm. and you stick a thumb drive in, and mm-hmm. you have a file named foo,
mm-hmm.
all capital, and you have a file named foo, all lowercase. Mm-hmm. They'll both go on the thumb drive.
Mm-hmm.
And then I take that out and I stick it in this machine, what happens?
You'll still have those two separate files.
Yeah.
You would have to address them. How they get addressed would be interesting.
Yeah.
because you'd actually have to set up that system in order to be case incentive in order to actually.
So therein is the problem. I mean, that's just part of the problem.
I mean, if you wanted to access it on another machine, you would have to access it with the lowercase in order to access that lowercase file, and you'd have to access it with the uppercase if you wanted to access the uppercase file.
Yeah.
So they're two separate files. That's how they're stored. But it, like I say, it's going to cause some issues.
Yeah. But it is possible.
It is possible. We really, really, really don't recommend it.
And the way to do that is everyone now go to, no, I'm just kidding. But it's HKLM system, current control set, control session manager, kernel, ob case insensitive. So yeah, if you want to roll those dice, then there you go. But I didn't know that was possible. He learns something every day.
If you change it and something goes wrong, really don't email Defrag.
Yeah, seriously.
We told you.
Yeah. All right. Next question. I bought an HP DV7T quad core, nice laptop, edition laptop last week with Windows 7 Home Premium. I own a licensed copy of Windows 7 Ultimate. And wanted to do a fresh install since I didn't want to pay HP to do the same thing. After several botched attempts, long bunch of texts. How do I proceed? So end up wiping out the hard drive. Had all kinds of problems trying to do this upgrade. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing here that you can learn from this, Windows Anytime upgrade. If you want to go to Windows 7 Ultimate, and I just did this the other day. I had a neighbor who had some old software that only ran on XP. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, I use XP mode. Mm-hmm. And he was going to build an XP machine, like specifically for this software.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, no, I just use XP mode, which I love, by the way. It's awesome.
It is extremely useful.
Yeah. So, but he had a version of Windows that didn't support XP mode. Mm-hmm. And so then he was going to, like, you know, flatten the machine, do the backups, and do all this stuff. And I was like, no, don't worry about it. Just put the key in. Mm-hmm. It's so simple.
Mm-hmm.
So long story short, Windows Anytime upgrade. Very simple to upgrade.
Yeah, do the Anytime upgrade. And then after that point, if you wanted to remove software that came pre-bundled with your machine that you would rather not have, you can do that.
So one of the questions he asked me, though, that I didn't know off the top of my head is if you do Windows Anytime upgrade with mm-hmm. a new key for Ultimate, mm-hmm. does that free up your old version if you want to use that on another PC?
No.
No. All right, then. All right, next question. I tried to find this, but still not success. I'm searching for a complete offline installer for Windows 7 IE9. Which should not check for updates to install. Does anyone know of an offline installer for IE9?
Indeed, it is off of the download.microsoft.com. If you search on this KB 982861, you should find, you know, IE9 Win 7 x86. There's obviously an x64 version.
Mm-hmm.
If you go down to the bottom, you can find the 64-bit versions, the additional downloads. This is 17 meg file.
Yeah.
This is the offline installer.
There you go. Awesome.
Now, what you will have to do is, of course, make sure that your machine is up to date, because there are prereqs for IE9.
Yeah.
So if you still don't have those prereqs, then it will still fail.
Yeah. Okay. All right, next question. I have an application I want to install, and the installation file is on a network location on our LAN. There are several users who also need to run this installation. Is it better for me to copy the installation locally and then run the install, or simply run it from its network location? I'm asking this because I'm thinking there might be file locking or performance issues with running it from the network. You had a good point on this.
We run our Office installs and Windows installs off of the network primarily.
A lot of us here. So there's 90,000 of us somewhere, you know?
Most good installers, what they will do is they will have to copy files locally.
Yeah.
Right? And that's part of the install process itself.
Mm-hmm.
So really depending on the size of your install, like whatever it is that you're installing, it will more than likely just benefit staying up on the network.
Yeah.
And again, most installers can do concurrent installs, you know, multiple people pulling off of it.
Mm-hmm.
If your server is, you know, a single disk system server, running off 100 meg per second network, you're gonna have.
And you got a lot of employees, and they're all installing this at the same time.
Yeah, you're gonna have issues.
Yeah.
You know, if this is in an enterprise scenario, what you may also want to consider is using something like SCCM to deploy applications instead of having people go and install it themselves. Yeah. Because you can actually set that stuff up to happen in the background. You can have it staggered, you know, and have, say, only 10 people do it at a particular time. And that's done by the software itself.
Yeah.
So, again, lots of different options. I'd say leave it on the server. You know, there's no point in adding additional complexity.
But and, of course, there's an easy way to test it. Install it at the same time on two machines and see what happens. And should be fine, though.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, pick of the week time. It is pick of the week time. And my pick of the week is a Forbes article that talks about Microsoft's view of the future workplace.
Okay.
It's brilliant, and why? So do you have it?
I don't have it.
You don't have it? Oh.
What is it?
Okay, it's Forbes.
Okay.
Microsoft's view of the future workplace is brilliant. Here's why. This makes for good TV.
Well, here it is.
Yeah, there you go.
First shot.
Yeah.
Hello, Bing.
There you go. An ad.
An ad.
Makes for great TV. All right. So anyway, this is a little mobile thing that Microsoft takes around to show people what the future workplace might look like. Interesting article. People may or may not know that we have on the campus here, we have Home of the Future, which is really interesting. But what many people probably don't know is we also have an Office of the Future. At least we did. I haven't been over there in a very long time. But it kind of explores, you know, what types of ways are people going to communicate in the future? What do we need to be thinking about? And a lot of stuff that happens at Microsoft, I mean, this is where these things get dog-fooded and are dog-fooded. I guess it'd be dog-fooded. Dog-fooded? It just doesn't sound right. But it gets tested, and then these are some of the places that we get our inspiration for a lot of the products that we do. This is a version that travels around. I was really excited when I saw this, and I wrote the guy that runs this, and I said, hey, you know, Adam, can we come over and do a shoot? I want to do a campus tour with this. He's like, yeah, and I went to set it up, and he's in Chicago.
Oh.
So now I got to go to Chicago. But anyway, it's a very interesting article, and you can see some of the stuff they talk about. Of course, you know, social is a big part of it. Conference rooms are kind of, you know, someday conference rooms are kind of be, they're going to be the dodo of business because, you know, virtual and Skype and all this, we'll all get together virtually. The other thing was gamification of the workplace, which I think is interesting. I used to work with someone named Nora Paul, and she thought that gamification was going to happen across the world. And
I have no idea what gamification is.
Well, like, look at the Coding for Fun project where they have achievements for Visual Studio. So if you write like a million lines of code, you get the, you know, long writer achievement or something like that. It's like putting little incentives that make people want to do other things. So,
as opposed to a paycheck.
And, well, in addition to a paycheck. So, yeah. But
so you're saying that gamer points won't actually replace cold hard cash?
Yeah. I guess it depends on the person. But yeah. But anyway, the person I work with, Nora Paul, she now teaches at UAM. Her thing was she wanted to do this with news, and she thought that, you know, if you had kind of an incentive for news, and, you know, people would get into that, and I don't know.
I think it would be cool if, you know, we adopted Halo-style death matches in the workplace.
I know that. I know you do. Yeah.
Headshot.
Yeah. All right. Nice. Okay, so, and then Ghost Pick of the Week, Private Cloud.
My pick of the week is people have been asking about...
people who don't want to keep their files out someplace.
Well, it's not just people, it's enterprises.
Yeah.
It's, you know, they want to be able to segregate the cloud as opposed to allowing any individual third party have complete control.
Yeah.
So we actually have evaluation software, Microsoft's own evaluation software for System Center 2012 plus Server 2008 R2. This will allow you to, you know, test the water, so to speak, of setting up an enterprise with a private cloud, see how it works with the infrastructure. You know, it will walk you through policies. It will walk you through just the general setup and the mentality of what a private cloud is going to do for you and your company, and kind of abstracting away the services aspect of what it is that you're that you're doing. So you can start managing your IT resources a little bit better. You can start, you know, simplifying things or at least conceptualizing the simplification of your IT environment.
Very nice.
So, yeah, I'd highly recommend, you know, anybody trying this out. It's free. Comes with a lot of different stuff. I mean, System Center 2012 is, you know, the latest offering. Comes with a bunch of security features, the endpoint protection, operation manager, you know, diagnostics, telemetry, inventory. So, you know.
There goes your weekend.
Oh, absolutely.
Awesome. All right. Well, that's the show for this week. If you want to email us, defragshow@microsoft.com. You can leave a message in the comments. We prefer the email so we can go back and forth with you. And we will see you next week.